Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the Bits and Pieces MMA podcast. My name is Duncan Price and I'll be your host for today's podcast. I'm the editor slash owner of Bits and Pieces MMA and I'm joined by our deputy editor, Mr. Paul Anderson. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon.
Good morning, good afternoon and good evening. Yep. Whatever time of the day you're listening to this. We're going to jump right into it, I think, with tonight. UFC 174 comes to us from Canada. I think it's Vancouver, I could be right in saying. Vancouver, the Rogers Arena, headlined by Demetrius Johnson and Ali Bagautinov. I think I've said that right. For the flyweight title. What I'll do is I'll just do like we normally do. I'll tell you what we've gone for, what myself and Paul have gone for with the result of that fight, and then obviously we'll have a little chat through about it, why we've gone for that. So as I say, the main event, Demetrius Johnson and Ali Bagautinov. We've actually both gone for Demetrius Johnson via decision. He's obviously the current champion. So Paul, why have you gone for Johnson via decision?
Well, I think Bagautinov is going to be tough to finish, and whilst he has been rising through the ranks, you know, quite a lot and has definitely earned the shot in that. He's never been in a five-round fight, so I think Johnson's plan is going to be to drag it out as long as possible and just tear him out with just being really hard to hit and try and frustrate him. And
yeah, Johnson's game plan is often to I hesitate to say grind them down, but he's so energetic, isn't he? He almost makes you tired just watching him, I think that's probably going to be his game plan. Like Bagautinov he would probably say his strength or his area where he may be able to trouble Johnson is if he sort of lands some quite heavy strikes, I would guess. But I would suggest that would probably be more suited against an opponent who's going to stand in front of you, and try and sort of trade. Whereas Johnson, as we know, kind of will bounce around however the hell he likes just to get escape from your strikes and try and land a few sort of his own, but you don't see it going to a finish though.
No. Although Johnson has surprised in his last two, he's had all this criticism about being unable to finish somebody, and then he goes, "Okay, I'll have a sub-banded knockout in two consecutive fights."
So he can just take it however he wants it. Yeah. I must admit, I think that there's a couple of unknown variables with Bagautinov. I mean, I don't know if anyone's really hit him hard. Whether Demetrius Johnson is the person to do that is probably up for debate. But I would suggest that his chin hasn't been horrendously tested at this point. I think someone pointed out, I was hearing yesterday, he's only been in the UFC for 9 months. So he's certainly had a sort of a fast rise up the rankings, although obviously the flyweight division are relatively thin division at the moment, but I guess the other variable with Bagautinov, like you say, is not having been in a five-round fight, and that can, I'm sure certainly, impact on, certainly on your game plan, and it's possible, I guess, that he could sort of tire quite easily. But I think we've both obviously gone for Johnson via decision, but I don't think we'd necessarily be surprised. Would you be surprised if there was a finish or?
No.
Just on the balance of probability, it would seem that Bagautinov seems to be relatively difficult to finish, and Johnson, energy for days, as it were. He's sort of like the Duracell bunny. I did run into him in the for the weigh-ins. I forget which event it was, but the guy, he looks small on TV, but the guy is small. He's very small. I mean, I'm not horrendously tall, but he can't have come up to more than my belly button. Sure. But, that helps, for these sort of five round, where he sort of legs it round the ring and throwing strikes and grappling and stuff like that. So, I think Johnson, obviously, the the clear favourite in that one. But you know, Bagutinov, try and say it again. you never know, do you? I'm hesitating to say that, to count Bagutinov out based on the Dillashaw factor.
Yeah, that's what it's called now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm christening it, the Dillashaw factor, i.e. once they get in the ring, does Bagutinov become sort of absolute beast who absolutely destroys Johnson, and, you know, we think, why the hell did we think Demetrius Johnson was that good in the first place? But I think it is just that at the moment. It is the Dillashaw factor. I think most sort of sensible people will probably be picking Johnson for that one.
How much of an underdog was Dillashaw, actually?
Oh, I think it was at least 5 or 6 to 1, at least. Yeah, yeah.
Bagutinov's 4 to 1 at the moment, so...
There you go, yeah. So I think Dillashaw may have been a slight higher odds. But it just goes to show, though, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a two-person fight. You know, there's only really... Yeah, I know you could have a draw, but there's only really going to be two outcomes. So in an event with two outcomes, you know, 4 to 1, 5 to 1 is actually quite often worth a punt, you know, because you never know what happens when you get in there, you know, and every now and again there is a shock, and hopefully, you know, if you know what you're doing, you put your money on the ones, you know, you feel that are going to cause that shock. But I can see why he is 4 to 1, but you know, maybe it might be worth a pound with a five fight accumulator or something with that as a last fight. That would certainly bump it up to 100 to 1 or something, I should have thought.
Yeah.
But don't hold your breath. So we'll move on to the co-main event, which is Rory McDonald versus Tyron Woodley. You have gone for McDonald via decision, and I've gone for Woodley via decision. So why have you picked McDonald over Woodley in this one?
Basically because I don't care. this was one of those ones to me. It was pretty much a coin toss, and Rory, I was probably just thinking maybe edge it out, you know, trying to, you know, keep on the outside and, you know, try and, you know, stay behind the jab, a la, you know, GSP in his later years, and you sort of work it out on points that way, and you try and avoid the power shots of Woodley.
Yeah, McDonald does have a lot of the sort of GSP technique, doesn't he? In the you know, or he certainly seems to have in the last fights with the sort of jabs and the kicks, and you know, I don't know, I can't. When McDonald was coming up through the ranks, I was quite high on him. You know, he had a lot of potential. He was quite exciting. Now I'm finding it all a bit sort of like, you know, he doesn't seem to be that sort of same dynamic, exciting fighter to me.
The thing is, when he looked brilliant whenever he was ragdolling people about, and these were people who were natural lightweights, you know, like Diaz and BJ Penn, who he just looked, you know, completely a step above them.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, against, you know, Lawler, who's a big, big guy, he just looked so flat.
Yeah.
And, you know, Woodley, again, is a big, powerful guy, so that, you know, that could be a factor in that as well, so it's...
Yeah, I mean, that was my sort of gut feeling with going for Woodley via decision, but it's one of those ones, I think, where you can really make a case for either guy, and I think until they sort of start striking, start, you know, getting in the clinch, you're not really going to be able to tell who's going to have the advantage. You'd probably say McDonald is probably the more technical of the two, but then I'd probably say Woodley's the more likely to, say, land a massive KO.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the wrestling of Woodley will probably come into play. I mean, McDonald obviously trains with GSP and everything, so I can see his takedown defense being quite good. But I think if Woodley can kind of keep him pressed up against the fence, or, you know, stop McDonald from kind of counter striking him the whole time, then I kind of see that as an area where he might be able to dominate the excuse me, the fight. To be honest with you, though, I could see it being a sort of like a 29-28 type fight. I don't see one man completely dominating the other, and I think they are both hard to finish. So I see it going to a decision. I think it'd be 29-28 either way, but I just think Woodley, there might have been a few question marks over his sort of cardio, because of obviously he's kind of so muscular. But he seems to have been fine the last few fights, although they haven't obviously, been going to decision. But I think in a 3-round fight, it probably won't hurt him too badly. Carrying that sort of the muscle that he does. That was my sort of gut. But yeah, I mean that's kind of like you say it's a bit of a pick'em fight, isn't it?
Quite literally is. Whenever you look on a Paddy Power here, they are both 9-10.
Exactly. So you can really make an equal case for both guys. Both have their strengths, it's an intriguing one. But I don't see. I know there was talk originally of this kind of the winner of this one being the next challenger for the welterweight title. That seems to have gone by the by now. They've announced Lawler and Brown. I think they've kind of said the winner of that one will get a shot of the title. I did see an article, I think it was on MMA Junkie, saying that Woodley still thinks he can get a title shot from winning this fight. I mean, I don't see how that's going to happen, because I think if he walks out and he KOs Rory McDonald in the first 30 seconds, you could kind of, it'll probably get passed off as, a bit of a massive swing, lucky punch, but does he really deserve a title shot off of it? And if he wins a decision, then everyone will say, well, it wasn't that impressive in a performance, So I just think, I don't think the UFC is that high on either of these fighters. No. I think they can promote Brown or Lawler against Hendricks a lot better.
Yeah, definitely. Lawler's going to be a rematch and all that, and that was a fantastic fight. I mean, you're just going to have the hype train of that forced down your throat for 2 weeks.
Exactly, and if Matt Brown beats Lawler, then Matt Brown is the guy who's won 8-9 fights in a row. He's beat the number one contender, so
he'll be a machine and a beast and a murderer and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So that sort of script kind of writes itself, whereas I think with McDonald, I mean, he's got a fairly recent loss, I think, hasn't he, and so is Woodley within the last sort of 3-4 fights. So I think that was kind of the point Dana was making, that Lawler's kind of most recent loss is to the champion. Brown hasn't lost recently, so how could anyone really argue that they're not the two who should fight for that sort of elimination spot? It's a sort of an interesting fight. It doesn't have the same gravitas that it did when it was potentially going to be for the next welterweight title challenger, but I think it'll be worth a watch, even just to see, just to see who does hold the upper hand out of those two. I think if Woodley wins, then McDonald could end up being one of these guys who's always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Always gets to the number one slot or near the top, and then fights someone who is at the top and just can't quite get there. Because Woodley is the sort of guy you're going to have to beat if you're McDonald to get that shot and ultimately win the title, and you could probably say the same about Woodley. So as I say, intriguing fight, but it's sort of as a co-main event, it's not too bad. Obviously it's in Canada, so Rory McDonald will obviously be getting a lot of support, not quite as exciting as it may have appeared a few months ago. What we'll do now is we'll discuss some of our the sort of hot topics, the things that have happened in MMA this week or last week between the time of our last podcast. So what we'll have a chat about first is the debacle this week of Chael Sonnen failing his drugs test. Give you a bit of background just in case you've not read anything online or heard anything or seen anything, which is probably unlikely, but Chael Sonnen was asked to take a drug test at the same time as the infamous Wanderlei Silva running away from the drugs tester at his gym situation. Sonnen was tested at the same time, and the results this week were released. And it was found that he had tested positive for two banned substances, anastrozole and clomiphene. And actually, I believe he subsequently admitted to taking a third banned substance, which probably didn't do him any favours. And he basically tried to pass it off as, TRT's banned, I was told I needed these things to help me come off the TRT. I knew they were banned. I tried to tell people that I was taking them, but you shouldn't really tell me off about it, or I don't think it's, I should face any sort of punishment for it, because I'm not actually fighting now or when the test was taken. I'm fighting in a month's time. I think I've covered the basics there, but Paul, what were your thoughts on it, and fill in any blanks I may have missed there.
Thoughts were like, what? Quite frankly, it's like, really? Chael Sonnen failing yet another drugs test, and after saying that he's told people about this and that, and I don't remember him ever saying, oh yeah, I'm off TRT now, but now, as part of my, I don't know, rehabilitation, come down process, whatever, I have to take such and such. Like, do you recall any of that?
No, absolutely not. I mean,
That's not to say it didn't happen, but I certainly don't remember any of it.
he may have said some things about coming off TRT, but I mean, I would certainly there would have been some red flags raised, certainly by the media. I mean, there's a lot of people in the MMA media who watch a lot more stuff than I do. So I'm sure if he'd have said, "Oh, by the way, I'm coming off TRT and I'm taking these three banned substances," you don't think that someone like Ariel Helwani or someone like that wouldn't have gone, I don't think you're really allowed to do that." So he's saying he's told people, but he's obviously not told anyone who's gone, that doesn't seem like a good idea. And he hasn't disclosed it once again, which he's admitted. He didn't disclose it to the Athletic Commission.
Yeah, I mean that's the first thing that he should do. Like, it's especially after whenever he failed because of the TRT, this because he didn't disclose it on one particular event, because he already disclosed it on a previous one and allegedly thought that was him in that state for the duration of his career. But you kind of think, hang on, I should probably tell these guys something,
Yeah, and one of
after
his
what happened to me before.
exactly. Once bitten, twice shy, or two or three times bitten with him. But I think one of the things he said, he kind of came up with like a little bit of an excuse for every single thing that anyone levelled at him. I think the thing is with the commission, I believe he said something along the lines of, this is not a direct quote, so obviously you have to take it slightly out of context, but he sort of said something along the line of, well, they don't give you forms to disclose things when you're not in competition. So how was I supposed to tell them? I don't know. Ring them up and say, I'm taking it. Is there some way I can disclose it?
NSSE.com.
Exactly. You would just
I'm
you
assuming that exists.
as soon as you as soon as you go, you do something like that, even if there's not an immediate thing of like, oh, okay, I'm right, okay, there's this form that I'm supposed to disclose it on. You would say to your agent, or you would say to someone, in your inner circle, can you contact the Athletic Commission, because I think I'm going to need to disclose this and I need to know how to do it. It's not that complicated. And then if the commission doesn't have something in place, then it's then fine, it's not your fault. Write them a letter or something, keep a copy of it and say, I sent an official letter notifying of it, but it was just kind of like, oh well, I didn't have a piece of paper to hand to tell them that I was taking it. And it's like, well, you can't, that's not an excuse, because you haven't followed up on that. You haven't made the effort. You've just gone, well, if there's nothing here, then I must be all right to do it. And obviously, quite clearly, he's not.
Yeah, no,
And it's
there
so
really
hypocritical,
is
isn't
no
it?
excuse for that. I mean, like, if you go to the dentist, you have to tell them what medication you're on, for goodness sake,
Yeah.
It's
And to just say, I didn't have the opportunity to say it. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, apart from anything else, when they were bloody drug testing him, surely when they were testing him, like, they, oh, we're doing a drug test. Oh, well, I should probably let you know that I'm on this, this, and this. But no, he just hoped that he wouldn't test positive for it. At the end of the day, that's from what I've heard, that's what I believe he was basically waiting for, is because he said he'd taken tests that said it was out of his system, and obviously the UFC have done sort of more, or the Athletic Commission have done more stringent tests, and turns out it wasn't out of his system. So it is a case of he wasn't going to mention it unless he actually was found, guilty of taking it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which is just, you can just tell that's sneaky. you know, anyone can work out, you know, even not in the world of MMA, anyone can tell you, you know, if you don't disclose something and you hope it isn't going to happen, when it happens you say, oh yeah, I did it, then quite clearly you were hoping against hope that they weren't going to find anything, and you're only admitting to it now because they have found something. Three things, well, two things, and then one he sort of subsequently admitted to. But
that kind of almost makes him a legend, to be fair, though, doesn't it? It's like, yeah, he only found two.
I had another one as well that you didn't even find. Yeah, I mean, I think it. I don't know whether there's been a bit of discussion, because obviously subsequently this, you know, it's part of the same sort of discussion, I guess, is he's basically retired now.
Yeah.
So. I guess just to kind of avoid the kind of furore that there would have been around him getting re-licensed and stuff, although I do believe he is going to have to appear in front of the Athletic Commission still, even though he's not, you know, applying for a license, because I'm assuming they're going to give him some sort of ban, in which case he wouldn't be able to reapply for a license, obviously, until that ban was over. And obviously a second offence now. Second sort of drugs related offence, I believe. I don't know if he had been found guilty of any before that. You know, so obviously I would have thought they'll come down on him fairly hard.
Yeah, well, it's like it's the Stephen Bonner factor, though, isn't it? It's like, yes, yeah, so what? I've retired now.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say to you, do you think it's sort of tainted his legacy a bit, or?
What legacy? His legacy? Is this a, you know, want to bend the rules, I guess, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you make a good point. I mean, he was never a title holder or anything. No. And he'll still be on TV, I guarantee it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Because people want to see him and he's an interesting guy. I mean,
he is a good analyst, you know. Yeah. That's the thing he's...
I think that's partly why some people are so sort of frustrated and annoyed by this sort of thing, though. It's because it's one of those things where you don't expect sports people that you like to do something wrong, and it really upsets people when that does happen. You know, I mean, it's happened sort of like in all sports, but when there's a sportsman that people actually like, and then they do something wrong, you kind of think, I like that guy. How could he cheat on his wife or shoot his neighbour or, you know, torture cats or, you know, I'm not saying Chael Sonnen's done any of these things, but I think it's kind of like a personal thing, because you think, I like this guy, and it turns out he's a bit shifty. So I don't know if there's an element of that. I think another big element, obviously, is the fact that a lot of people are looking forward to the Chael Sonnen and Wanderlei Silva, Chael Sonnen and Vitor Belfort, and now it's just nothing. It's gone, totally gone.
Yeah, that diminishes the value of the tickets we bought.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, this is something we'll go into with our UFC 175 special. But I mean, certainly there were three big fights on that card, and one of them is gone now. It's not even a replacement. It's just completely gone. It's just completely been scratched. So it kind of makes it into two big fights. And when you really analyse them, it's probably really one big fight, because I think everyone pretty much expect Rousey to blow through Davis. It's kind of like one of those mandatory challenger bouts. So it makes the card start to look a little bit weaker. And I think there's a little bit of frustration around that, certainly because, you know, it's in that sort of fight week and everyone's pumped for that card, and, you know, that's an incredible fight. It wasn't even the co-main, you know. So I think there's a little bit of frustration sort of surrounding it there. But, yeah, it's just very hypocritical as well, because he was, you know, slagging off Wanderlei for sort of running away from one and saying, well, you know, that means he's on drugs. You know, admittedly, Chael Sonnen didn't run away from one, he took one, but his point was, well, he must have run away because he's on drugs, and Chael was as well. So there's certainly a hint of, being a bit of a hypocrite there, I think, as well. But, like you say, he's a liked guy, as in, you know, his analysis is good, he's interesting, he's sort of... WWE style sort of rants that he goes on are quite funny, so I can see him, you know, he's retired. I saw a tiny bit of the Q&A with Josh Thompson and Carlos Condit yesterday, And they were kind of saying the guy's busy 24/7 because he does a lot of TV now. He's got other interests and stuff like that. So, you know, he'll probably miss the kind of the actual fighting. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's not going to be sitting around at home twiddling his thumbs. So I think we don't have to worry about that one. So, but yeah, that's sort of a bit of a cluster something all round that one, really, wasn't it? You know, that whole situation. And I don't know, in some ways maybe it's better that a fight or a version of that fight doesn't go ahead just because of the surrounding, you know, thing. And you know, would it have kind of given, you know, credence to some of opponents of MMA saying, you know, look, this guy's pumped up on steroids and he fought and, you know, blah blah blah. So yeah, another fight down the toilet for 175, but hey-ho, you know, hopefully none of the other ones go, so we'll be all right. So the other big news this week, kind of this week slash last week, was the absolutely despicable piece of judging that meant that Ross Pearson lost via decision to Diego Sanchez. This was at the Fight Night 40-something... in New Mexico and Albuquerque, yeah, which is relevant, we should say, Albuquerque, New Mexico, yeah, because that is basically where Diego Sanchez is from. Although whether that played a factor into the decision is difficult to say, because, you know, Dana came out afterwards and he said, look, none of these judges are from Albuquerque. So he's like, the judges really shouldn't be, you know, biased, because they're not from there. You know, we deliberately pick.
You know?
Yeah, he said we deliberately get judges who are not from that state or not from that, you know, area, because otherwise they could be biased. But essentially, to sort of recap it to the sort of a shortest degree, Pearson outstruck Diego Sanchez in every round. He scored the only takedown of the fight, which I think was in the third round. Is it third or first? And he scored the only knockdown of the fight in the second. And one of the judges actually scored it, Jeff Collins, let's name and shame. He scored it 30-27 for Diego Sanchez. So even the round where Diego Sanchez was knocked down by Ross Pearson, he still gave the round to Sanchez. And even Sanchez in the post-fight press conference came out and said, oh, I thought I won it 29-28. So even he knew...
Yeah.
He hadn't won a round. but still, one of the judges scored it 30-27. And the only reason we're not talking about the other judge, Mr. Chris Tellez, scoring it 29-28 to Sanchez, is just because of this ridiculous 30-27. So what were your thoughts on it as you sort of watched it unfold, Paul?
Just, God, Ross is really, really good. You know, his
footwork,
isn't he? You just pick them apart, and that's, you know, That's exactly pretty much what I expected. You know, Diego Sanchez, he sticks the head down and, you know, looks like he's just swimming. And that's his style now. And against, you know, somebody with as technical a footwork and striking as Pearson, that's going to be his downfall. And that's pretty much how it played out. And then Diego Sanchez gets his hand raised and it's like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, you know, it's not really hyperbole to say that it is probably one of the worst judges' calls ever, because he did not win a single solitary round.
No, exactly. No, I mean, I've seen it called, yeah, exactly the same, like you say, one of the worst, if not the worst. I think some people have been saying, yeah, the judge's decision in the history of the UFC. I really couldn't see how they were giving it to Sanchez, really. He was just walking forward. Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's not really octagon control if you walk forward and get punched in the face, you know.
Yeah, you know,
that's not octagon control, you know. Just being aggressive isn't good enough if you're getting, you know, outstruck and, you know, everything. I couldn't understand it at all,
yeah,
really. But
you just can't block punches with your face for 15 minutes. And
no.
When I fight it, that just doesn't make sense.
No, I forget where I saw it, but someone made a very good point that Diego Sanchez, I think, is 3-3 in his last six fights. But the point was quite actually articulately made that he's actually 0-6.
Yeah.
Because the three victories he's had, a lot of people thought he lost those three fights.
Yeah, starting Kampmann fight, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, there was certainly a case to be made. I wouldn't say there were as bad judging decisions as this one. However, a lot of people thought his opponent won, you know, the other two of these, you know, three fights. So you could really put out a good case that he actually should be 0-6 in his last six fights, which would be sort of, you know, cutting territory, basically. But yeah, the kind of sort of subsequent fallout to this is that Pearson and his camp have put out an application to the New Mexico Athletic Commission to see if they can get the decision overturned. But my understanding of reading the rules is that it's very, very unlikely, if not impossible, because they would basically have to prove that that the fight was somehow fixed or the judges were paid or, you know, something like that. If it's just a crappy decision, I can't see anywhere in the rules where that is going to get overturned.
No, I don't think it's going to get overturned at all, but in spite of the fact of that as well, Pearson did get his win bonus anyway.
He did. Although I noticed that they also gave Sanchez his win bonus, and actually his appearance money, I think, was $70,000.
So he
took $140,000 home, whereas Pearson's appearance money was $30,000, his win was $30,000. So even if they hadn't have given Diego Sanchez his win bonus, which they did, I suppose they felt like they had to.
Yeah, I guess
he still would have got $10,000 more than Pearson with his win bonus, which seems a bit of a funny way of, you know, of being paid. But obviously Diego Sanchez has got a very good agent. But yeah, I mean, obviously we'll kind of speak a little bit about, you know, why it won't get overturned or why it shouldn't get overturned. Although I believe that Pearson won, it is my staunch belief that it should not be overturned. And that's for one reason and one reason only. If you overturn a bad judge's decision, every single time there's a judge's decision, the fighter that loses will lodge an appeal and say, watch it again with Fight Metric and all this sort of stuff. I want it watched again and, you know, then decide the winner. Yeah. In which case, the decision in the cage becomes like a preliminary decision, not the actual result.
Pretty much. I mean, if that was in place and this exact same fight happened again the exact same way, you know, Diego Sanchez would be going, I'm appealing that. I won that.
Exactly.
He was punched so hard he believed he won it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there are close decisions and where you do think they could go either way. You know, it could be two 29-28s one way and a 29-28 the other way. Well, if you watch the fight back and it turns out that, you know, fighter A landed 51 strikes and fighter B landed 50 strikes, then you have to say, oh, okay, well, he won the fight. Oh, yeah, but he got a takedown. Well, how many takedowns is worth one, you know, strike? And it would just be far too overanalyzed. And like I say, I'm sure the majority of fighters that lose a decision, unless you get your ass handed to you, I'm sure the majority of them think, I think I won that. Because they've just been punched in the head quite a few times as well. You know, and quite often they get back to their corner and they'll say, oh, am I winning? And, you know, sometimes they're honest, you know, and say, no, you know, whatever, you need to finish. And occasionally they're like, yeah, you won that round. And you're thinking, did he?
Pet peeves, you know, yes man in the corner.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you need to be told what's, you know, what's the situation is, don't you? But I mean, that's going to lead the fighter, even if he did lose the round, that's going to lead the fighter to, you know, lose the decision and then go, oh, I'm appealing it. And just, you would just get so many appeals of decisions, because you can't say, well, Diego Sanchez and Pearson was such an obvious one, we're reviewing it, and then say, oh, we're not going to review yours because it seemed to actually be close. If you open the door to appealing decisions just because the decision doesn't seem correct, then it's just going to be pandemonium. And I don't think athletic commissions can cope with it, because they can't cope with a lot of the stuff they have to do now, to be quite frank.
No.
If they have to go back and start reviewing decisions all the time, it's just going to get ridiculous. So for that reason, apologies to Ross Pearson, because he's a nice guy and he won that fight, but that there's no way that should be overturned, in my opinion.
No, it shouldn't. And at the end of the day, I mean, all it is, it's going to be a number on his record. It's not going to affect where he is in the company. You know, he's a fairly popular guy. He's not like he's being cut after it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And, you know, it's not going to change his... Like, even you, the media who do the rankings, they're not going to take that as they shouldn't.
They know what happened. Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone apart from Sanchez knows who won that fight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think the UFC did come out, didn't they, and say we're treating it as Pearson won and Sanchez lost, and they'll both be matched up, you know, with sort of subsequent fights accordingly. I'm wondering how long Diego Sanchez has got left of being punched repeatedly in the face, because at first it was quite entertaining, you know, they were kind of back and forth wars, but now it's just like, how many times can he get sort of like punched in the face and stuff like that, and just be coming forward the whole time but never actually really do anything?
Honestly, it's getting to the point where I kind of don't even really want to watch his fights anymore.
Exactly.
You know, this is just a dude just getting punched in the face.
That is my point. You know, the Campman fight, you can kind of say, well, it was back and forth, it was exciting. But now it's not even that. It's kind of, it's almost like slightly embarrassing almost, because he just...
Tragic. You know, it's just another guy who doesn't know when to hang it up, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And he's obviously not going to be getting a title shot or anything soon. So, you know, even with his sort of positive attitude or whatever it is, I think he... I don't know. I could see the UFC, if he picks up a loss, maybe two, I could see him going, because he's getting paid a lot of money as well, and they are starting to factor that in, I think. You know, when you look at the cuts of like Akami and Fitch and stuff, they are pointing to the fact that these guys are not getting in the title picture anymore. They've had their opportunities, and we're paying them 50,000 plus to fight, 50,000 win bonus. We could be paying 100,000 to beat nobody, to get nowhere. So I could see him doing a similar thing with Sanchez, to be honest with you. If he loses another one, maybe say, or maybe renegotiating his contract and saying, look, if you know, you can have another fight or two, but you know, it's gonna have to be at a lower, you know, a lower contract or something. Yeah, but
that's present then for his management to go off to, you know, a competitor, and that, yeah. they'll snap somebody like that up. It's a big name. The egg will go there and probably get punched in the face there too for
exactly.
15 minutes. And, you know.
To be fair though, I think that's
where one more.
Yeah, I think that's where some of them probably belong. I know it sounds depressing, but you know, I was one of the people who, when they cut Jake Shields, I mean, obviously the guy's, you know, excellent on the ground, but I think he was like 3-3 or something in his last three fights, and some of those were, it was a bit like Diego Sanchez, some of those were either incredibly boring, or he only just won, or they were, you know, they were quite close decisions. And I kind of thought, you know, maybe World Series of Fighting is the place for someone like that, because he is going to be back near the top. He probably might have a shot, he probably would get a shot at the title. You know, he's got name value, he's a good fighter. You know, I don't know whether I would suggest that some of these people would be better off in World Series of Fighting being a somebody than being a who cares in the middle of a UFC division.
The point of saying that he was maybe boring is that kind of just rubs me the wrong way a wee bit, because so what? It's a sport.
Yes.
It's, you know, that's a factor in it. But to be fair, that is what the promotion forces on you. It has to be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that is quite
the best versus the best. And if your style is the best and it looks crap, You're still the best.
That is a really philosophical question. We'll have to discuss that possibly on another podcast. But I mean, I would only liken it back to something like Rory McDonald and Woodley, where we're saying, yeah, we're not that excited about these guys that much anymore. You know, and unfortunately, with the amount of UFC on nowadays, and I don't know whether you do the same, possibly not. You're probably a bit more hardcore maybe than I am, but I get to some of these fights and I think I'm pretty much going to fast forward through it all. Unless it starts off like the first minute or two quite exciting, I will. If I don't care about the two fighters, I'm fast forwarding the majority of it. And I'm finding a lot of people are saying the same thing, and I think it's just because, I mean, I would hesitate to say that, you know, Jake Shields is, you know, a bit of a higher up guy, but certainly some of these prelims where you don't really know a lot about the fighters. You may have seen them once or twice before. I know there's obviously an argument of, well, if you don't watch them, you won't get to know them and stuff like that. But, you know, when there's like 12 hours worth of events, you kind of just feel like, or certainly in my situation, obviously, you know, having a family and all stuff like that, I can't really justify sitting there for like 6 hours watching the UFC. So I kind of have to make a choice about what I'm watching, and so therefore, if I see a fight where I know two people are gonna sort of duke it out, or it should be a back and forth battle, or it'll be close or whatever, then I'll kind of make the effort to watch that, bell to bell sort of thing. If I see two fighters I'm not that bothered about, or a fighter I don't like the style of, I'm quite often fast forwarding through that fight, and that may be sacrilege to say that, but it just does, it slightly plays to the fact that I just don't want to see someone grinding on someone else, on the ground for 5 minutes a round, 3 rounds, without really doing anything. So, I mean, it's the equivalent of like watching a football, like a nil-nil draw. Most nil-nil draws are dire. Every now and again, you get a nil-nil draw that's a good fight. Between the two football teams or whatever, you'll get a good game. It's just that neither of them can stick it in the net, and very occasionally that will happen with a fight. But normally, if you get the kind of MMA equivalent of a nil-nil draw, it's boring. So, I don't know. Like I say, it's a philosophical question really, because like I do kind of, I 100% see your point, and I would argue that if you are the best at what you do, then you should be, within the promotion. But I guess with Shields, my gut was his record wasn't great. He didn't really have a lot of fan support necessarily. I think his skills and talents were underappreciated, but then again, like it wasn't like he won the title or was probably ever going to win the world title. Not in the UFC, obviously. Strikeforce a bit thinner, and I just think from a personal point of view, if I was Jake Shields, I'd be thinking, well, if I go to World Series of Fighting, they'll probably pay me at least the same amount of money. I'll be fighting at the top of the card, if not the main event, and I can probably continue another 2, 3 years. Whereas with the UFC, obviously you're going to hit a certain point where they're going to go, look, you're old, you're losing, you're not exciting. Why are we keeping you? So, but yeah, that is a very good point. That's the sort of Ben Askren point, isn't it? The kind of why is someone like Askren not in the UFC yet? They get all these people who are on the prelims who you think, this guy, they must have just pulled this guy out of a bar or something. So yeah, it's a good point. We'll shelve that for another day, shall we?
Yeah, I still watch all the fights. I just fast forward through the talking.
Well, I'll fast forward through all that as well,
So there's
but
a lot of some of the prelims I just don't even bother with anymore.
well, that's the thing.
I'll watch the main card and, you know.
Yeah, so you're basically making a decision based on looking at the card. Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of what I do. I'll look at the prelims and I'll think, well, who knows? There could be a really great KO or something, or maybe it'll be a really good back and forth fight. And that's why I kind of, even if I'm not that bothered about the fighters, I'll give it like a minute or two into the first round just to see what they're doing. And if they're just feeling each other out for 2 minutes, I'll just be like, right, yeah, fast forward, or if one of them takes the other one down and the other one quite clearly doesn't seem to be able to get back up, same thing. I need a hook to some to make me watch some of those type of fights, and otherwise I just fast forward it until what eventually happens, a decision or some sort of stoppage. So,
Yeah,
but
well, my top tip for that is, watch the main card. That's where most of the bigger name fighters and that is. Then go and look at the results and the bonus awards. And if there's a bonus award on a prelim, watch that fight.
That's a very good point. That's a top tip for you guys listening to the podcast out there from Paul. Write it down. That's a good, yeah, I like that idea. I may start doing
Thank you for help.
that. So now we'll go on to our submissions section. This is where we are given questions to answer for you guys in the most eloquent way we can. And so our first submission this week is a topical one, given the fact that the football or soccer World Cup has started. And it is, given the popularity of the Football World Cup, Soccer World Cup, could a similar competition ever happen or be successful in mixed martial arts? Over to you, Paul. What are your thoughts?
No.
No?
No.
It's another one of your classics.
How? All right, so you're gonna have like teams basically from each country and all that. then you're also going to have to factor in weight classes, and then this tournament is going to take them out of their respective organization, because obviously this is going to have to be global. You're going to have one grand aggregator that takes into account all the different promotions from the UFC down to whatever you have down the road on a Saturday night once every 6 months.
You're basically saying the logistics of it would probably make it very difficult. Yeah.
It would. And you're going to have champions, you know, putting their belt on the line and that, and you know, you never know. They may lose.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess
Do you host it?
Well, that's a good point. You'd have to have it a different place every 4 years, wouldn't you? Like the football one, if we're suggesting it would be anything like that.
3 years is a long time in MMA, too.
It is, that's very true, yeah. I mean, I guess one of the main obstacles would be the fact that in sort of like football and the majority of the sports, you're obligated to play for your country or whatever it is for your country. By the governing body, as far as I'm... You know, unless you retire, you know, what I'm saying is that if, say, for example, England want to call up Wayne Rooney, they say, we want to call up Wayne Rooney to Man United. Man United can't say, no, you can't do that. Oh. They have the overall say. As long as Wayne Rooney hasn't retired or doesn't, or you know, wants to go. Whereas with the UFC, if there was some governing body of mixed martial arts, I guess something like along the lines of this, is it the IMMAF or something? The International Mixed Martial Arts Federation? Something like that. I think that's what it's called. The kind of thing where they're trying to get all the world under one umbrella of kind of, you know, standards and rules. If they said to the UFC, can we have John Jones to fight for the USA? Then UFC would say, no, you can't.
They would say two words, the second of which being off.
Yeah, exactly. So that, in my mind, that's one of the main obstacles, because at the end of the day, even if John Jones wanted to go, he's contracted to the UFC. So as far as I'm aware, he couldn't really get round that. It would be down to the UFC to allow him to compete outside of the organisation. Whereas obviously in the majority of professional sports, there is a global governing body and like a governing body of that individual country. And therefore, if the sports person wants to play for the country and the country wants them, then the club team or franchise or whatever can't say no. They can't be the one to veto it, as far as I'm aware, in the majority of sports. Whereas, as far I would have thought with UFC, basically, they would have the right to veto, and therefore, if they said, well, we don't want any UFC fighters in there, then you start getting down to the sort of World Series of Fighting. They may say the same thing, because obviously they've got a lack of star power, you could argue.
They don't want to have what talent they have being removed and potentially then shelved for whatever. It's like, oh, our champion just happened to get knocked out. That's a 60-day suspension.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and then they'll have to plan their events and pay-per-views in the UFC's case mostly around that.
Yeah, I mean, if, say, the UFC did allow John Jones to go and fight for the USA or whatever, he hurts his toe again and he's out for a year, then obviously that impacts on the UFC, so they wouldn't, certainly if they did release him to do that, they would be, certainly once bitten, twice shy. Can we have... I'm trying to think of something. Can we have Demetrius Johnson for the flyweight? No, you can't, because we gave you John Jones and he bloody got injured.
And over how long would this take?
Well, that's another good question, because you couldn't fight really, in theory, it wouldn't be a good idea to fight more often than once every sort of couple of weeks or something, would it? So,
no.
I can't really ever see. I know, I think I did mention to you before, M1 Global tried to kind of do a similar thing, didn't they? I don't really know what M1 are up to at the moment, but I know they had kind of like a league table and stuff like that, and they were
they had like different teams from different countries and so on.
Yeah. So I guess that's probably about the cool. Actually, the point I was going to make, which I've just kind of half reminded myself of, I think probably the closest MMA would ever get to the World Cup is if they ever manage to get it into the Olympics. I think if they ever manage to get mixed martial arts into the Olympics, which I think we're still probably 15, 20 years off, I think, getting it into the Olympics. But I suppose that would be the closest you could get to it, if that makes sense. I mean, I've done a piece before on having MMA in the Olympics, and there would obviously have to be a lot of rule changes, and I think, to be honest with you, the rule changes would probably take a lot out of the sport. Much in the same way that, obviously, like Olympic boxing, you know, they've got head guards and all that sort of stuff and different scoring and, you know, really so that, you know, they're not taking damage day after day after day, you know. And I think that would probably be a similar thing with MMA. I think they'd end up with, like, head guards, probably. You might end up with more like a boxing glove type style glove, you know, covering.
That's going to be hard to submit someone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they'd obviously it would have to be adapted, I think. But you can get these ones that cover the ends of the fingers, I think, can't you? They've been suggested
before. Yeah,
they're
like a training glove type thing.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think that would...
7 ounces instead of the usual 4.
Yeah, I think that would be the sort of thing they'd probably have to do to get it into the Olympics, because I don't think... I kind of hate the word, but I think the brutality at the moment is a bit too much for the Olympics. It's a bit too... you know, a bit too brutal. There's a few too many knockouts, and I don't think they would sanction something quite as violent as it is. You know, not to say, you know, obviously it's a legitimate sport, there are rules, but I could see they'd have to dumb it down a lot to get it into the Olympics. But I must admit, I could see, if it got into the Olympics, I could see fighters running down their contract and then going and fighting in the Olympics. I think it's something GSP talked about before, that would be something that, you know, had they have got the Olympics into MMA into the Olympics, that he would have liked to have done, you know, gone and fought, you know, for his country at the Olympics. But I don't think it will happen while he's still around. But I could see that being a draw. I think it's some sort of World Cup sort of type thing. You know, I don't think it would have the, you know, the draw, the sort of weight behind it to kind of make fighters want to leave the comfort of the UFC, the relative comfort of the UFC, to go and fight in one. Whereas the Olympics, you know, I mean, everyone knows the Olympics. It, you know, yeah, that is kind of the pinnacle for many sports, you know, of where they're going to. So I guess that would probably be the closest it could ever come to, like, a national sport, as it were. Yeah, maybe one day. It'll be there. I'd go and see it, certainly. So, what do you think about the chances of it getting into the Olympics?
Again, it would just take a long, long time to do so, and there'd have to be, you know, the changes and all that would diminish what the sport actually is. You know, if you're having head guards and all that, and you're like these different types of gloves and you know, shin guards, etc., it's going to be really, really hard to have the grappling as a facet of it. So it kind of just means, well, they're going to be forced into more of a kickboxing style, so might as well have kickboxing then.
Yeah.
You know, take all that off, have grappling.
Look, I mean, you might have a view on this more so than I have, but I could potentially see something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu getting in there before MMA, to be honest with you.
Yes, I hope so. That'd be great.
You could be, I was going to say Northern Ireland's first representative, but of course it would be Great Britain and Northern Ireland, you see.
Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why you have to be, I don't know why you're an and, but surely it's just all Great Britain, I don't know. Some political thing, I guess. But, yeah, you could be their first Olympian. BJJ.
Scotland, England, Wales, but the British Isles is the big bit and the wee bit that is Ireland.
Yeah. Oh. I sounded patronising when I said that. But yeah, I could certainly see, given the sports that are in the Olympics already, I could certainly see BJJ getting in there. You know, I don't think they would really have to amend the rules massively to have...
I wouldn't. I mean, there's lots of, you know, competition, jiu-jitsu tournaments and all that out there anyway.
I don't see it as any different or legitimate to, like, judo or...
Yeah, you know. I mean, like, they both stem from the, you know, the same parent of, you know, Japanese jiu-jitsu anyway, so...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you heard it here first. So we'll go on to our second submission of this week, which is worse, hitting an opponent after the bell or pushing a referee who has stopped the fight? So I'll give you guys a bit of background if you don't know about this. Obviously, hitting an opponent after the bell is kind of a reference to Paul Daly, who it's kind of rumoured that he will, or is attempting to, get back into the UFC. Apparently he's made sort of contact with Joe Silva and, written him a letter expressing him remorse, and you know, actually, beg your pardon, I don't think he actually wrote the letter. I think apparently it was other MMA fighters in the UK wrote a letter on his behalf saying, you know, that he's a different guy and you know he's a stand-up character now and etc etc etc.
And he didn't write it himself.
Yeah, apparently he hasn't got an agent at the moment either, so that's why they did it for him. But which is a bit of a strange situation, because I always remember him having an agent before, so they obviously have some sort of disagreement. And then obviously the pushing the ref is a reference to Jason High. After his fight was waved off on the weekend, he shoved the referee Kevin Mulhall. So yeah, but in your opinion, which is worse, hitting an opponent after the bell or pushing a referee who stopped the fight?
To be honest, they're both, you know, different sides of the same coin, really. You know, you're fighting, the only time you're ever doing it is between bells, and you shouldn't be, you know, trying to sucker punch your opponent or be an ass to the referee who's only doing his job. You know, they're pretty much one and the same in my book. You know?
Yeah, I mean, they're both sort of quite clearly
outside. You're gonna do either. You're just a bit scummy.
Yeah, exactly. If you've kind of got the instinct to do that sort of thing, then it's a difficult one, because there's quite a bit of support for High in the sort of media saying that he'd just been punched quite a few times. He wasn't very happy. Heat of the moment. You know, he's done something wrong, but is it really worth cutting him? Whereas Daly kind of, he'd had a minute or two to think after.
Well, he was still just, you know, I was, you know, just right, that's the end of the fight, right? Bell's wrong. He pretty much stood up, walked around the referee and swung a dig.
And it just, yeah.
Minutes, it was there and then. You know?
Yeah, yeah, but it wasn't sort of like literally just as the fight finished. I think he was just carrying on some malice that he'd had because Koscheck just laid on him pretty much for three rounds and he wanted to sort of duke it out. I don't know, I think there's a bit... I sort of think hitting an opponent after the bell is slightly worse, just in my own brain, slightly worse, just because, like I say, Hyde kind of had his bell rung a few times and he virtually got straight up and pushed the ref, and I don't think he really knew what he was doing, whereas I think Daly knew what he was doing. I think he knew, I'm going to lamp this kiddie because he's wound me up. Because I've met Paul Daly a couple of times, and that strikes me as the sort of thing that goes through his head. I've never met Jason High, so I can't comment on that, but he seems to have a little bit of remorse about it. Whether he should have been cut or not, that's a tricky one. That is a tricky one. I guess I'd support that. I don't really have a strong opinion either way. I wouldn't have been annoyed if they'd just, say, like, banned him for a year and fined him or something. I wouldn't have had an issue with that either. I mean, Dana White saying, put your hands on a ref, you never ever in the UFC again, but he said many, many times, you punch your opponent after the bell, you're never in the UFC again, and obviously Paul Daly is working his way back in. So how much do you think that is a commercial decision on the UFC's part to kind of re-establish contact with Paul Daly?
Oh, 100%. There's so many more events and all that now with the global expansion, etc. There's going to be a few more UK events, Fight Pass worthy, and someone like Paul Daly, he's got a bit of a reputation and name about the regional circuit that he's in at the moment, obviously with Bama and so on. That would be a draw for a Fight Pass show anywhere in the UK. So it's another name that they can add to the roster to flog tickets and Fight Pass subscriptions.
Yeah, I think the UK has kind of lacked a guy who is going to sort of stand and bang with the best sort of thing ever since, obviously the situation with Dan Hardy, not really being able to fight. I think we like a fighter who can sort of stand and bang here in the UK, but equally can win doing that. And we don't really have anyone like that at the moment. You know, Bisping's certainly not that style. Pickett can be, but he's quite inconsistent at the moment. Like, he'll have a good fight and then he'll lose one, or it'll be closer than you think it should be. Or, but again, Pickett is a guy like that, where you know they kind of stand and bang, and you know that they can win, rather than they sort of stand and bang and just get picked apart, which is what happens to a lot of the sort of strikers who come out of the UK. You know, or they just get wrestled and they just don't know what they're doing. So I think they've kind of missed a guy like that who could be a sort of a, maybe not a title challenger, but up in the top sort of 15, 10, 15, who's got a bit of name value and also puts on an entertaining fight. Like you say, for the UFC, that's money all day long, really, isn't it? I'm guessing he would probably have to come in on quite a short and cheap contract for the UFC to let him back in, but, you know, he has got a couple of losses recently. He lost to one of the guys, I can't remember the guy's name, but they were talking about it the other day because he just recently fought in the UFC, and basically he got into the UFC off the back of he beat Paul Daly. So they were sort of talking about that. So he has got some recent losses, although I think overall his record recently has been pretty good. I know he's been competing in kickboxing bouts as well. Here we go, Alexander Yakovlev. Yeah. Oh, he was the one who just fought Maya, was it? I think. I could be talking rubbish. Here we go.
I believe. Yeah. So. That
he
sounds
is.
Familiar.
Yeah, he was the guy who just lost to Maya. But yeah, basically they were saying he got into the UFC off the back of he beat Paul Daly. And that was only in November of last year. So, you know, Daly's not exactly riding a massive win streak.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And he fought... He's 1, 2, 3, 4... He's 5-1 in his last 6, so it's not too bad. But, yeah, I mean, obviously, I think that defeat probably set him back a tiny bit. But, like you say, you know, the guy's got name value. He's quite an exciting fighter, you know, so as long as he keeps his head down and doesn't start swinging at people after the bell again, I think you could see him back in the UFC fairly shortly. Possibly, I would maybe say on the February card, the London February card, purely yeah. because apparently he's got outstanding contractual commitments. I'm thinking maybe, I think he's got a contractual commitment to Bama. I think he's got one to one of the other promotions, I forget, in Europe, but I think he was pretty confident about being able to get out of them all, except potentially the Bama one. I think he felt like he would probably have to fight one more time for them, so, you know, I could see him maybe on that February card in London, assuming all goes to plan. But yeah. So, we'll leave you with our Gareth A. Davies biscuit of the week. Now, I can't remember what we had for the one before.
It was a dark chocolate hobnob.
Dark chocolate hobnob, good knowledge. But basically, after we'd announced the Gareth A. Davies biscuit of the week, I actually tweeted to Gareth A. Davies just to see if he had a view, an actual view, on the biscuit of the week. Because I hate to say it, but we actually make up the Gareth A. Davies biscuit of the week. So we actually sent a tweet out to him and, you know, asked him what would be his biscuit of the week, and he actually came back with a brilliant answer. Paul, would you like to reveal that answer?
It was the ginger nut.
Yeah.
And I should have to... I'll look through my Twitter here, actually, to see...
I'm just doing the same thing, the actual tweet that he sent back. See if we can find it. We want to say it word by word, you see. It was basically linked to the fact...
Ages ago, that was
yeah.
too many.
It was basically linked to the fact that there were three fighters, I think, who were all... slight... Had a hint of ginger in their hair, or... I don't know, in their demeanour, I guess. But I think it was like Miocic... who were the other ones? Barnett, and there was someone else. Oh, it was, George Groves. Yeah, George Groves. So there were three fighters that he was going to be keeping an eye on who were ginger. So he went for the ginger nut. So officially, we had an actual official biscuit of the week. So in honour of that, and the fact that obviously on the last show we couldn't put that in, this week's Gareth A. Davies biscuit of the week is the ginger nut. In honour of the once slightly maligned but now total legend, Gareth A. Davies.
I still can't find this tweet.
So we will... You found it, hooray!
No, have you?
Oh. No, I think it's been deleted forever. I should have it in some sort of favourites or something, but I don't even know. They're forever reorganising Twitter, and I don't know where they put things. So, you know, I don't... It'll be somewhere. People can check it, I'm sure, somewhere, you know, if they want the literal word-for-word translation, as it were. But yeah, our biscuit of the week is the ginger nut. And thank you to Gareth A. Davies for letting us know. We will be looking for our next biscuit of the week for our next podcast, which I think will be sometime after UFC 175, because we've got very busy schedules. And as you will hear subsequently later on down the line, myself and Paul are actually going to be in attendance at UFC 175 and Ultimate Fighter Finale 19, so we'll be recording a sort of a preview show that you guys can listen to and see what you think of, so hopefully you'll enjoy. I think that about wraps it up for this edition of the podcast, the fifth episode. We're still going, we're keeping on. So I say thank you very much to my co-host Paul.
All right, thank you, no problem.
And, we'll see you when we see you.